Next case on our docket is People versus Carlos Gallegos, case number 2009 SC 1084. Case is set for 45 minutes per side. The petitioner, you have to keep track of your time, which you haven't done very well this morning, through no fault of your own, I might add. Petitioner ready? Defense ready? Okay. And what I said about the iPad, I can see that the weather has internally has discouraged the audience, so I don't think I'll repeat it.
So for the record, Kathy Gillespie for the People, registration 26109. Gallegos comes before the court on, I think, two different prongs that we can look at in the overall SVP framework, and that is the definition of established and also the appropriate remedy in these cases when the Court of Appeals does not agree with the finding of the trial court. I want to go back just quickly to the crux of, I think, where the court is and where the people are asking the court to go, and that is that authority to define that relationship status.
Do me a favor.
Sure.
Just speak a little bit directly into that microphone.
Okay.
Thank you.
So the crux of, I think, where the court is having difficulty is that authority to define the relationship types. And I've given the court a couple of statutory sites, which I'm not going to go through again, but I do want to point out a couple of other things that I have mentioned, but maybe not quite as clearly as I would have liked to. In Title 183.414.5, subsection 2, where it talks about the probation officer and the evaluator filling out the PSI, the mental health evaluation, and then the sexual violent predator risk assessment, I do want to point out that within that statute, they talk about the risk assessment screening instrument in Part 4, and then talk about the bigger document, which is the SVP assessment. And the assessment in subsection 2, I think when it uses the phrase the assessment, it's a fair interpretation to say that that is referring to the same assessment that they're discussing in that subsection 2 and not necessarily referring back to subsection 4. Otherwise, I think there would have, as is the case in most statutes, would have referred back to that assessment. Also, if you go down into number 3, which deals with the parole board using, in the situation where the parole board's going to make the SVP finding, it says the parole board shall make findings based on the results of the SVP assessment, not the risk assessment, the SORs, but the SVP assessment. Also, in subsection 1 of that Title 3, 183.414.5, before it even talks about the four prongs of what makes an offender a sexually violent predator, it says, as used in this section, unless the context otherwise requires. And again, remember, the statute came before the evaluation itself was fleshed out. And also, in the evaluation itself, and I understand, Justice Marquez, that this isn't going exactly to how far you would like it to go as far as it does with subsection 4, but at the top of the evaluation, and the one I picked was the 2008 of the evaluation itself, the SVPSI ASI, Part 2, Section E, says before the three relationship criteria, and this is a quote, the relationship categories are identified in federal and state statute. The following definitions were developed by representatives of the board, the Judicial Department, and the Department of Corrections to assist the court and the State Board of Parole pursuant to 16.11.7 in the identification of undue risk. For purposes of this document, undue risk includes the designation of a sexual predator as outlined in subsection 3. So tying that into the opening sentence in Title 183.414.5, I think what there is support for this court finding is that the definition of promoted, established, and stranger is to be defined in the category of the sexually violent predator statute, that we're not talking about just somebody who generally goes out and promotes, but we're trying to narrow that category down within the relationship of trying to identify these predatory sex offenders. So I would point the court to that, and also just reiterate for the court that the dictionary definitions, as we've seen in Tixier and some of the trial courts and some of the court of appeals have used, don't solve a lot of the factual problems that this court is has been discussing throughout the day about the, you know, the timing of the facts that lead to support the relationship. So I'm not sure that the difference between defining it in a dictionary and defining it closer to what the SOMB does is going to solve a lot of the issues that this court has. In fact, I think if you go with the Webster's or the more general definition, I think you're going to find more problems than if you use the narrower definitions as the SOMB is defined. And I think that's true too when you look at jury questions. You know, when a jury asks a question about the meaning of a word, the trial court will define it in its context of that particular crime, or it will just say, use your plain understanding of the term. And I think that's what's happening here, is we're looking at the sexually violent predator statute in a civil context without the same protections and burdens as a criminal issue. And I think there is support in Title 16 and Title 18 for this court deferring to how the SOMB has defined it. In the alternative, if this court is not willing to either approve of the SOMB's definitions and direct the trial courts to use those, I do think that as this court goes to give guidance, it needs to give guidance on those words in the context of the sexually violent predator. Because while a more narrow definition of the term does maybe leave some people out, I think it's important that we're only designating those defendants as SVPs that do pose that type of risk that community notification and the more frequent registration is designed to protect. And that goes back to what I opened with, which is there are some cases here that when you send it back to the trial court, depending on which way you define these relationship criteria, dictionary or SOMB standards, there may be some that we lose. But I am comfortable if this court uses the SOMB guidelines, that if we lose those, maybe those were defendants that weren't necessarily meant to be caught within the net of this SVP. Whereas if you're using the dictionary definition, there is a chance that we may lose some people that the experts would say, hey, that guy right there really needs to be tagged, and we're not tagging them because we're not using words defined in the relevant context.
Can I ask you? Oh, go ahead.
No, I was. You said there might be some additional problems, or it would cause additional problems. What specifically are you referencing?
Well, I think that for instance, the timing of the promoting a relationship that Justice Marquez pointed out, and I think somebody else did too, about can it be the facts of the crime? Can it be within an hour of the crime? Are we talking about 6 months, 3 months? And I think with the checklist that the SOMB has given, granted it's not perfect, but it does, when you look through those factors, guide the evaluators and in turn guide the trial courts to looking at specific facts. So, you know, if you define somebody as promoting a relationship for the purposes of sexual gratification or abuse, that example I used where the father walks into the bathroom and, you know, there's an incident with his daughter, under the to change or to promote dictionary definition, there are some trial courts, as they did in Uribe Sanchez and also in this case, that will find that that's promoting or establishing a relationship. Whereas when you look at the exact definitions from the SOMB, in addition to that factor, so in addition to changing the focus, they also want to see that it was progressively more sexually intrusive, there were multiple contacts, and that the offender did something to establish control of the victim. So they're taking that promoted definition in kind of a general sense, which is changing the focus of the relationship, but they're adding to it factors that have to be found in order to reference it to the sexually violent predator.
So you, one of the problems you're talking about then is that we would be expanding who would fall under the umbrella of sexually violent predator, then. That's one problem.
You might be.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. Second question I have is, one of the problems that you're indicating is, and I'm asking if you think this would cause a problem, where we're going to start having more lengthy evidentiary hearings under certain circumstances. Do you foresee that as a...
I do, and it's hard for me sometimes to think like a defense attorney, but if I was a defense attorney and I had one of these defendants before the trial court, I would take some comfort in the fact that when I walk into sentencing, I know exactly what the court, what factors the court is looking at. So I know what the playing field looks like. And I can be prepared walking into that hearing to say, all right, well, this, you know, the evaluator found these denial factors or these factors over here. So I'm coming in with evidence armed to refute that. If it's a broader definition under the dictionary where it's not a list of factors or it's not something more specific, I walk into that trial court and it's a judge that I'm not familiar with, and he finds, based on some factor that he thinks is relevant to the sexually violent predator, and I'm caught off guard by it. And now I want, you know, an opportunity, judge. This was a factor that you considered that I didn't think you would. So now I want time to go back and bring you that evidence to refute what you think on this particular issue. So I think the consistency factor is huge. And I think that coming into the sentencing with, for that that second part of the sentencing, for that civil determination, I think if there's no evidentiary hearing and it's a preponderance of the evidence, I think at least the defense can take these factors too and say, okay, I know that if I want to challenge what the evaluator said, I need to hit these points because these are the factors that are relevant to whether or not my defendant needs to be tagged as a sexually violent predator. So it's not usual, but I find myself in a position.
It's actually very familiar to me as a former juvenile judge. So.
And a mom,
you know what you're postulating sounds a lot like, you know, when you get CFI, Certified Family Investigator kinds of reports, and you are looking at them as a judge and trying to decide. And what my experience tends to happen is, you know, you have another trial on the evidence which went into the making of that report. And I guess that's kind of what you're concerned about as well, but...
And I think so, because if the factors aren't delineated, and obviously I'm arguing that I want you all to go with the factors delineated by the management board, mm-hmm. but even if you came up with your own factors of at least walking into those hearings, everybody knows what is being considered. Now, we can argue what the evidence shows. You know, if the factors don't list something as far as a time limitation, I can look at these factors of promoted and see, well, progressively more intrusive, but it also says that established control and used force. Well, that tells me that you're looking at the facts of the crime. So it just, I think in order for the trial court to use discretion, it has to review and make a decision based on somebody else's information. Everybody has to be on the same page. And I think that's what happened in Uribe Sanchez is, you got the court coming up and saying, well, I don't think he promoted the relationship based on this dictionary definition. But if you use these factors, I agree that one and two were found. Well, how do we know, you know, at that point, everybody's bouncing around between, is it this or is it that? Whereas if you come up with the factors, and to me, it only makes sense to use the experts that deal with these cases day in and day out. As to what they're seeing from defendants that reoffend and what predator type sex offenders reoffend in what manner, it just gives the framework within which the trial court, the defense attorney, the prosecutor, everybody's on board with what we're looking at, and then we can argue about whether or not certain facts meet that. And in
Ms. Trusty, can I just
interrupt
you? I think I introduced into the argument the word factor. And in your opening brief in this case, you talk about four criteria. Is that the same as factors or not?
Well, the four criteria are the four sexually violent predator criteria. Those I don't think we can change.
Right.
The factors I'm talking about are...
We have those anywhere?
They're listed in the evaluations for the SOMB. So under, like under established, it says, it lists four factors that the court, that the evaluator looks at in order...
And that's part of our record? We got that?
It is. There should be an evaluation in each case. Out of those four factors, the SOMB directs the evaluator, if you find two of four, that defendant has established the relationship for the primary purpose.
What are those factors? Just
For established, it is the offender has a history of multiple...
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
If you look at the second one, the offender has actively manipulated the environment to gain access to the victim. Isn't that true? I mean, that's a very, very broad... It's not a factor. It's a description that's pretty encompassing, right?
It is, and it's a... The way I would describe it is it's a factor that is asking if certain facts are present, and those facts would tend to point to the fact that, like in Candelaria, it was put forward that, you know, he just wanted to date this woman. He didn't have any intent to sexually, to commit a crime. The fact that he had actively manipulated the environment with the alcohol, et cetera, the fact that he had a history of multiple victims, all went to what his intent was when he established that relationship. And so...
That's a pretty easy case, I would suggest.
It is an easy case. And you know, one that wasn't so easy was the... well, is Gallegos, for instance. Because it was a plea, we don't have a lot of the facts fleshed out the way we would in a trial. But Gallegos is one of those cases that I said in the beginning, it's not really a question of we want to win or lose. We didn't like the reasoning of the Court of Appeals coming up with this dictionary definition. So you would take the facts of Gallegos as we know them and go through the four criteria of established. And I think this was the point that was made. This case was kind of a procedural mess coming up and what was at issue, but this would be one of those cases. So on the evaluation, it's listed stranger, established, and promoted. And the evaluators are told, if you find stranger, you don't look at the other two. If you didn't, you go on to established. Well, in this case, the evaluator got to established, found it, and so never looked at promoted. So the trial court, you know, used its discretion, agreed with the evaluator, found that it had been established. So that comes up to the Court of Appeals. Now, in my ideal world, the Court of Appeals would then have looked at this case using the same SOMB factors and said, you know, we don't find any clear error with the factual findings, but we find that those factual findings are insufficient as a matter of law to support the finding of sexually violent predator. Unlike the case in Gallegos where they just say, well, he doesn't establish, so that's the end of the ball game, that case then should be sent back down to the trial court to say, the findings were insufficient on the promoted. You need to look and see if there's anything else.
Since we're on that topic, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but did the people raise that argument before the Court of Appeals, either in their answer brief or on the petition for rehearing, the point about remand and...
We asked for in the alternative that be remanded for further findings on the promoted, because the trial court found established.
Right.
It was raised in the opening brief as challenged promoted.
And I may be mixing up my cases, but I seem to recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that the Court of Appeals had said we're not going to address this other prong because in fact the people didn't argue it. And so that's why I'm asking, maybe it came up in a petition for rehearing, or I'm just curious.
And I apologize because I didn't do that case, so I'm not completely sure. I know that the promoted was not addressed factually in the brief, and it may have been the petition for rehearing where we asked for it to be remanded to have it considered that particular factor. And I'm not sure between the two.
Thank you.
But it was also a problem in Hunter. A much more egregious one in my book, because Hunter, just on paper, looks a lot more dangerous when compared to someone like Gallegos. But in Hunter, the problem was the same. If the Court of Appeals disagrees with stranger, that's not the end of the inquiry, because clearly, if you look in my ideal world, if we're looking at the framework, he does fit under promoted. So that case needs to be sent back down so that the trial court can make sufficient factual findings on those others. And I think if this court comes out with this framework and addresses that remedy, one way to avoid the Court of Appeals and this court having to constantly review and keep sending these cases back is trial courts will very quickly realize that if I make alternative findings, like I'm finding him an SVP based on promoted, but I'm also going to make some factual findings under established just in case, then the Court of Appeals at that point could find clear error or not on the facts and then find, because it's a de novo review anyway, that it meets the sufficiency. So I do think that there are ways, once the framework is clear for the trial courts, that it can be worked below so that it is an efficient use of resources on the particular question.
Before you get too far away, or maybe you won't have time to ever get into this specific case, but I actually have a sort of a general question I wonder if you could help us out with. And it has to do with this question of due process and proof, preponderance, discretion. Could you just tell me, unravel for me, how the sexually violent predator works and what cases it applies to? And I tell you where I'm going. I'm wondering, do we have situations in which the underlying crimes would not be punished under the Lifetime Sex Offender Act, and you would have, where I'm sort of going is this something in addition to somebody who's on probation or parole, and so it's imposing an obligation of some kind for one's life, even though it's beyond what his sentence would be? Is that it, sentence in terms of incarceration to a term of years or parole after that, or probation rather than a term of years?
It does not change the prison or the parole period of a particular defendant. What it does is, based on a conviction of certain crimes, which are, you know, pretty much the ones you would expect of sexual assault on a child, first degree sex assault.
But all of those are sentenced under the Lifetime Sex Offenders Act, right?
They are. And so, remember, SVP came in first. And so the SVP defendants were then asked to register for the remainder of, you know, the remainder of their life. And instead of registering once a year, it was quarterly. And then community notification was added. After that came the lifetime supervision. So for a lot of these defendants today, it's, with the exception of the community notification, it's a distinction without a difference, because they're on lifetime parole or lifetime probation and they're registering. It may change the frequency of how often they have to register, but as far as the lifetime aspect of it, it's a little less, they're pretty much already doing it if they're sentenced under SOLSA, the Lifetime Supervision Act.
And do you know, from the time the Lifetime Supervision Act came in, would there be a situation in which you could have somebody who was not subject to control for life, who would have to register as a sexually violent predator?
You could on some of the attempt charges, because the Lifetime Supervision Act applies to Class 4 felonies and higher, and there are some of these SVPs that could fall in attempt. The other place that it would come into play is defendants who are charged, and this was the Hernandez case, defendants who have a prior can be when they come back in front of the court, can be reassessed under the SVP. And there are some defendants currently in prison that, as they come out, this whole SVP process takes place as part of the parole process. So if a defendant went in and, let's say, you know, 1997, right before SOLSA, he could be, and wasn't, for whatever reason, my dates may be wrong, but for whatever reason, he went into prison as a sex offender and wasn't given an SVP assessment. As he comes up for parole, the parole board will make that assessment, as the trial court does. And that's that section that I was talking about, subsection 3.
Right.
Again, refers to the SVP assessment, not the risk assessment that the parole board will do. And that's another piece that would play into this, is that if you put forth the framework as I'm arguing that I think it should be put forth, that's the same framework that the parole board's going to be using too, because it's coming from the SOMB. So every defendant, no matter how he enters into this SVP system, is going to be assessed the same way. Obviously, there's discretion within those factors, but at least you know, it looks like elements of a crime. At least we're talking about the same five things that equal this.
But we can have situations then clearly in which somebody is obliged to register as a sexually violent predator who is no longer on parole or probation.
Correct.
And do we say, and is that the terminology we use? We say, you have this obligation, but it's not a term of parole. You're not on parole. You just have to continue to do this.
You know, I'm not sure how once somebody...
I mean, if they don't do it, then is that a separate crime? Do they get, I mean, if they're not on parole, they can't get their parole revoked.
And I'm not sure if that comes in under the registration statutes, if they would then be charged with a failure to register, would be my guess as to where that would come in. I haven't taken it that further step past parole, and unfortunately, I'm just not as familiar with the parole rules and regulations as to how they come off and what's...
Well, that in any event becomes the executive branch, right?
Correct.
Parole decision, and so that would be more easily amenable or fit more easily with the sex offender management board.
Correct.
There wouldn't be that issue, I don't think, as much. But
not as much, but you would have the problem of some defendants, if they're coming in through the process now, or could be assessed in a totally different way than somebody coming out of parole, as far as whether or not they meet the qualifications for the sexually violent predator.
I suppose, yes.
And do we have, with regard to the sex offender registration generally, maybe, or this in particular, any law, I didn't go back and look and see any law dealing with the Apprendi type of requirements or problems? Is this treated as a further sentence?
It's not. This court obviously hasn't ruled on that issue, but the Court of Appeals, amazingly enough, has been consistent all the way across the board that it is not an Apprendi-Blakely issue, because the registration and community notification requirements serve a purpose other than punishment, which is the protection and to help law enforcement just keep track of these people, which is what the feds wanted done originally. Was when these violent crimes take place, they want to know what sex offenders are living in the area. So the Court of Appeals has been consistent about that.
The Court of Appeals has, however, held, I take it from these briefs, and I forget which one too in here, that proving the factors or proving the definition of a sexually violent predator is a matter of due process. And haven't they said that
they have,
things have to be proved by a preponderance of the evidence?
They have, and that it has to be a preponderance. And if there is, and it's not one of the cases before the court, but it's another Court of Appeals case, if there is an issue, and this will come into play probably in Allen tomorrow morning, is if there is an issue on a factor, for instance, one of the cases talked about whether or not he graduated from completed first grade. And because he was aware that those were the factors, the defense attorney came in for sentencing. They did sentencing, they got to the SVP determination, and the defense attorney was ready to go with, I've got his mom and three other people that said he did finish first grade. And this was one of those cases where his determination turned on one point. And the Court of Appeals said, if there is a contested issue, there has to be evidence in the record by a preponderance to support the trial court's findings. So if the defense comes in and says, no, I have, you know, his mom will say he graduated and so will three other people, the DA at the time and the trial court didn't have any information to support that finding that the evaluator made. It wasn't in the interview notes. And I think what the Court of Appeals eventually surmised is you have to go back and either give me support for that, because they've contested it. And again, that's, you know, if everybody's on the same playing field, we come into this determination knowing what factors we need to talk about.
And do you know, they've reached that conclusion, apparently it's a matter of due process, you have to prove this fact or otherwise you fail to establish sexually violent predator, and yet sexually violent predator is not a greater sentence?
It's not, because all the sexually violent predator does is subject you to notification and registration. So when I say they prove it, it's by a preponderance, and if the information in the PSI and in the evaluation is uncontested, the DA doesn't have to put on any more evidence. So
if it's not a greater sentence, wouldn't generally we be moving in the direction of saying that it's within the discretion of the court whether to grant something?
It is. Mm-hmm.
And in which case, it wouldn't have to be proved as a matter of fact, would it? I mean...
No, but if the Court of Appeals is reviewing the trial court's use of discretion, there would have to be some evidence in the record to support the trial court's decision, its ultimate decision on the SVP factors.
But not approved by a preponderance. He's not making a, he's not acting as a trier of fact if it's within his discretion, right? Or have I got that one? In any event, I think you've answered my question about where these lines.
Actually, just one quick point of clarification. Sure. Was that the Tuffo case that you were describing with the failure of first grade? Was that not, though, the fourth prong, the future risk prong?
It was. It was one of those factors on the future risk.
Just want to clarify that. Thank you.
And I think if you put forth this, if you put forth the framework that I'm asking for, I think that would take place whether it was on that fourth one or the third one. In other words, if you decided to, say, follow the SOMB guidelines, I think that would work on the relationship prong, too. If, you know, if I can't prove that you actively manipulated, or I can't show that you actively manipulated the environment, then that would be a contested issue, and this court would be just looking for clear error on the record.
And since you have 3 seconds left, could I have you just lay out exactly what was used to find promoted, what was relied on in this case? And I guess I'm curious about the factors into the SORS that was used at that time, and would those same factors be applicable into the current form?
In Gallegos, they actually, the trial court actually found established.
I'm sorry, pardon me.
Okay.
Established.
And I think, at least from my reading of the record, the trial court found the evaluator found that he met the first factor, which is a history of multiple victims. He had been accused before of sexual assault, and then number four, that he persisted in the introduction of sexual contact or inappropriate behavior despite a lack of consent. And this was the case where he went into the bathroom and touched the little girl while he was bathing her. And again, because it was a plea, it wasn't fleshed out very well, but what I could pull out of there was that he didn't normally take care of child duty responsibilities such as bathing the kids, and that he used bath time when the child would be alone to perpetrate the assault. Now, this is one of those cases where I'm saying that if you use these factors, I'm not sure which. I think it's a very, very close call. And I think,
Ms. Gillespie, on that last factor, I mean, every sexual assault is in the absence of consent. That's like a definition, right?
Well, the factor actually reads that the offender persisted in the introduction of sexual contact or inappropriate behavior despite the lack of consent.
Despite the lack of consent, or the absence
of the ability to consent.
Well, yeah, the ability is someone who's drugged or unconscious, but
right. And I wouldn't, and I'm not arguing to the court that these factors, some of these factors may be found in every sexual assault, but it's not just one factor. There has to be a certain combination under established and a certain combination under promoted in order to meet those two definitions.
It seems like it casts a pretty broad net.
It does, but in my opinion, not as broad as started or changed, and that's it.
It's not as broad as what?
Not as broad as the Webster's Dictionary definition that Tixier came up with, which is to change or to start a relationship without any of those. I mean, the dictionary basically says if number one is present, you promoted. And we're arguing that, you know, that has to be the combination that the SOMB is deemed relevant.
Well, but for the purpose of sexual victimization, I mean, some of these factors seem to go to that latter part.
Mm-hmm.
For the purpose of sexual victimization, if they go to anything.
I think so, too.
Okay. But it would seem to me that, I mean, you've argued here that these factors created by the SOMB ought to be followed because they narrow the class of potential offenders that would fall within them. And looking at the factors as I see them as used in this case, actively manipulated the environment, introduced sexual content. certainly, any sexual assault would include introduction of sexual content into the relationship,
mm-hmm.
Or persisting in the introduction of sexual content.
I
don't understand how that's narrowing. That seems to cover every conceivable sexual assault.
Well, the established, I mean, that could also go back to the situation I talked about where the father goes in to the bathroom and something happens of a sexual nature where he may not have actively tried to isolate the victim or manipulate the environment and didn't persist in the introduction. If he tried once, it wasn't multiple attempts.
Right, but,
I think
it's any two, right?
It is any two.
And so virtually any assault could fit those two. I mean, any assault you could check off at least two of those four boxes.
Well, except for in some of our cases, they don't. And if you take the established with those two, that doesn't make him an SVP. That's one factor you may find.
But that
predatory behavior then has to be combined with
that
the
might
source.
Be because of the discretion of the trial judge. That's why you only have 400 to 500 who are not exactly following the SOMB recommendations. Because they have a lot of discretion.
If they do, or they've been following the SOMB, and that's, you know, the majority of the cases, that's what we haven't seen coming up that way.
Is there any place else where those criteria are really detailed and explained?
Other than the handbook, which gives a little bit more guidance, a little bit more detail on each of those, like under the established, it'll give a little bit more detail on each of those factors.
That's not in the record, right?
Well, the handbook is, isn't it?
In any of these cases?
The handbook is cited in a bunch
it's
of
cited.
It's cited.
It's not.
And it's available online, I believe.
It is. Yeah. And I'm happy to bring it to the court tomorrow morning if the court wishes to.
We can look online, I'm sure. Thank you. We'll give some additional time, I suppose.
Good afternoon. My name is Leslie Goldstein, registration number 24658. I represent Mr. Gallegos. I'd like to start with the first issue, which is whether or not the Court of Appeals erred in creating its own definition of established relationship, and did the Court of Appeals err in finding that Mr. Gallegos did not meet the criteria that he established a relationship for the purposes of sexual victimization, such that he could not be classified as a sexually violent predator. I wanted to start off by saying that I take issue with the word created. I think that word implies that the Court of Appeals was without authority and was engaged in some sort of judicial activism run amok. I believe the authority for the Court of Appeals to define established is based on the fact that established is not defined in the SMOB. And specifically under Tixier, it says whether an individual is an SVP is a question of law. Further, we review de novo whether the trial court's factual findings are sufficient to support its legal conclusion that the defendant is a sexually violent predator within the statute. So there is authority for de novo review of a trial court's factual findings. In this case, the trial court, the Court of Appeals found two issues with the trial court finding that the relationship was quote unquote established. To begin with, the trial court misapprehended the term established and found by virtue of the victim, the child being the daughter of the defendant's girlfriend, that was an established relationship. And then based upon that finding, the trial court went on to find that there is no, I believe the phrase was, legitimate relationship between a 24-year-old and a 5-year-old. So the Court of Appeals said, to begin with, that's misapprehending the statute. Number two, the facts do not support that finding. What I think is very important in understanding this statute is the purpose, the legislative purpose behind the sexually violent predator notifications. Start off with the premise that not all sex offenders are sexually violent predators, and I think that's important. Specifically, I believe it was Linda Jones with the Division of Criminal Justice argued why there should be heightened notification and registration requirements for certain types of offenders. There was a quote, emphasis on those stranger-to-stranger sex offenses and where the predator is a stranger to the victim or cultivated a relationship with the victim primarily to commit the sex offense. I think that legislative history informs then 183.414.5 and gives meaning to what established and promoted is. In other words, we are concerned about certain types of offenders who are going to establish or promote a relationship primarily for the purposes of sexual victimization.
Could I ask you right there while you're at that point? It seems like a good point to ask. The Court of Appeals dwelt so heavily on distinguishing established from promoted. What do you see the difference to be, and do you think they were right in treating those as two different kinds of things?
Yes. Well, to begin with, under the SMOB and the RASI, they are separated out. There's established.
And so are you agreeing that we should define these terms according to the SMOB criteria?
I believe that those criteria are to provide assistance to the trial court. However, I would not advocate, as the state is, that the SMOB is the end-all be-all, because I think that essentially strips the trial court of any discretion in making those kind of decisions. I believe that you have Allen coming up tomorrow, but in Allen, that is a case where the evaluators found that the defendant did not meet the criteria, and the trial court still said, you know what, based on these factors, I'm finding defendant is a sexually violent predator. And I think in connection with 183.414.5, where it specifically says the court shall make findings, the court has to be given that discretion. I think that also goes to one of your earlier points, Justice Coates, that there has to be due process. There has to be a fair opportunity to be heard and to weigh in on these factors. I think if we are so narrowly construing this instrument, that is stripping away due process and stripping away the trial court's ability to have discretion. To get back to your earlier point, I do not believe established was met, nor can promoted be found in this instant case. What the trial court, or excuse me, the Court of Appeals did with the established criteria, though, is they essentially defined established and found, because of these variety of reasons, there is no established, and because there is no established, we're not even going to actually get to the four factors under established. And if you look at the RASI says an offender has established a relationship if two of the four criteria are met. If you go to the next page, they talk about promoted. There's actually a bullet that talks about what promoted is, and then it says and then there's four other criteria. So that is why the Court of Appeals is interpreting the statute, looking at the legislative history to understand what established is. So the Court of Appeals did not even discuss the four factors and the two specific ones that the evaluator found, which was the evaluator found, number one, the offender has a history of multiple victims and similar behavior, and number four, the offender persisted in the introduction of sexual contact or inappropriate behavior despite the lack of consent or absence of ability to consent. And the Court of Appeals didn't address those issues to any degree because it found the established was not met. And again, I believe that the Court of Appeals determination that a relationship was not established primarily for the purposes of victimization was clearly shown by the record. This was really not mentioned to any degree in the state's briefs, but what you need to understand is this is a relationship. Mr. Gallegos was in a long-term relationship with the victim's mother. In fact, he considered themselves to be common law married. They had a child together. That child was approximately 3 years of age at the time of this bathing incident with the victim, who he considered to be his stepdaughter. There was no evidence presented whatsoever that Mr. Gallegos initiated dating the mother of the victim in order to ingratiate himself to perpetrate on his girlfriend's daughter or common law wife's daughter. There is no evidence to support that. I would go next to the promoted category, which...
Shouldn't we just remand it for that?
No.
Okay, why?
To begin with, the evaluator made a determination that this was not promoted. But if we actually look at the criteria under promote, the evaluator did not find any of those criteria. So I think there's no reason to send it back because there already has been an evaluation. And in my reading of the RASI, I do not necessarily believe that established and promoted are mutually exclusive. I think certain evaluators could certainly find that somebody A, established, and B, promoted a relationship.
Counsel, could I actually interrupt you right on that point? Because as I read the instructions on the form, it seems to suggest that it is sequential. In other words, the evaluator is supposed to analyze the stranger definition first, and if the answer is no, then you move on to established, and only if the answer is no do you move on to promote.
I certainly think that is one interpretation, and I can say that I have certainly not had a case where both boxes.
That's expressly what the form says.
Right.
Summary of part two, relationship, tells you exactly.
And having said that, in this case, we have a situation where the evaluator found established. And I'm happy to talk about the fact that I think the evaluator was wrong in determining.
So your point is that, yeah, but I still don't see, okay, if we agree that it's not established.
It is not established.
Okay, and then we go on to part, to the third function. Right.
Well, but we have an evaluator who made a determination that it wasn't promoted.
Well, but that's because the instructions tell the evaluator that once you've found established, then you can't move on to promote.
Well, I believe that when the evaluator is looking at this form, the evaluator is looking at the criteria for established and then also looking at the criteria of promoted.
Okay, I'll have to go look at the instructions on the form. Thank you.
Here... Specifically, the evaluator checked for established that there was a quote-unquote history of multiple victims. That is simply not the case, and it certainly those facts are not established by a preponderance of the evidence. What we have is a juvenile adjudication for, I believe, a criminal trespass. He was required to undergo an offense-specific evaluation. Multiple victims, there is not a history of multiple victims. There was one prior victim. Additionally, on the other number four is, I apologize. The offender persisted in the introduction of sexual contact. I believe that the word persisted was used for a specific reason. Persist means to be insistent in repetition, keep carrying on, continue steadily or obstinately despite problems. Here we have an isolated one-time offense or incident, excuse me, where Mr. Gallegos was bathing his stepdaughter. That is it. So there's no evidence to support that there was attempts or prior times where there was bathing or attempts to get the child into the bathroom. So I believe that there's a specific reason for using the word persist is because we're concerned about offenders who continue in this type of behavior, not a one-time offense. So based on those issues, I believe that the Court of Appeals properly interpreted the statute and found that the Court of Appeals did not, or excuse me, that the trial court did not have sufficient facts to support its finding. Again, the last thing I would say for the second issue, which is whether or not the trial court should, or it should be remanded to the trial court for further findings of promote. I believe because there has been a determination on the evaluator that there was not, the relationship was not promoted, that a remand would not be necessary. So I would ask the court to affirm the Court of Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you. Excuse me, any other questions? No. That concludes the argument in People versus Gallegos. The case will be submitted on the